Hello, this is Robert Stearns. Hey, I want to thank you for tuning in. I really believe that learning is one of the greatest joys in life. And one of the greatest ways to learn is simply to have meaningful conversations, both with those who come from a similar background as yours, as well as those whose background might be very different. So my hope is that as we connect and converse with leaders from all around the world, that we will learn and grow together. If you're new with us, hit the subscribe button and we'll deliver the new episodes to you right away. So wherever you are, on a run, in the car, at the kitchen table with some coffee, welcome to the conversation. Hello, welcome. Really happy to have you along for this amazing conversation, this incredible ongoing conversation that has not happened for 2,000 years, but is happening in our generation. I find that so amazing that for 2,000 years, the followers of Jesus and the relatives of Jesus have been separated. They have not been in dialogue. They have not been in communication. The followers of Jesus, who are today known as Christians, and the relatives, the biological relatives of Jesus, the Jewish people, we have had a 2,000-year period of distance, of many times enmity. Horrific atrocities have been committed against the Jewish people under the banner of the name of Jesus, though those of us who truly follow Jesus would say that that was never the heart of New Testament Christianity. Nevertheless, history is very sad in its treatment of Jews by Christians. But in this generation, just in the past 30 or 40 years, and to be honest, especially in the past decade, there is a wellspring of conversation that is rising up between the Jewish people and the global Christian community, most specifically the evangelical Christian community, and we are thrilled to be a part of that. Well, if there's an example of this conversation that is growing, it is our guest tonight. He is a dear friend. I would call him a brother. But our relationship began with that same sense of, not really knowing how to relate to one another. Rabbi Yaakov Kirmayer, when I met him, was the rabbi of the illustrious Fifth Avenue Synagogue in Manhattan, and he was the president of the New York Board of Rabbis. And we met many years ago. I'm going to guess, I don't know if he remembers specifically, but I think it was at least a decade ago. It might have been closer to 15 years, somewhere like that. And, we were, especially rabbi, very understandably, coming from an Orthodox background. Is Bishop Stearns a missionary? Is he just trying to proselytize me? Is he just trying to, gain my soul and take me away from my Judaism? And we engaged in some wonderful deep conversations, and our friendship was cemented in a wonderful way. And then he and his family amazingly left the blessings of New York City and the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, and they made Aliyah to Israel, where he lives now with his family. And he formed a wonderful organization there that I want you to check out. It's called Yakir, Y-A-K-I-R. Which also is a name. It is usually I think a man's name in Israel. We have a dear friend, Yakir Ayal, the son of Shlomo Ayal, our chief guide. And he is working as a Jewish leader in Israel. He's working among the Druze community and among the Bedouin community. And we're going to talk about Israel's diversity and the different communities that live in Israel. And then we're going to talk about the calendar, and we're going to talk about the Parsha and all kinds of things. But he is joining us today all the way from Jerusalem. Would you give a huge Bishop and the Rabbi welcome to our returning friend, Rabbi Yaakov Kirmayer. And there he is. Rabbi, how are you, sir?
Hello, Bishop. It is a thrill to see you on screen. Hopefully to see you in person soon in Israel.
Bizrat Hashem, yes, we're finally, things are opening up. And you just told us a little bit ago before we came on the air that they've finally removed the mask mandates in Israel.
It is a thrill. Going to synagogue and praying without the mask over your face, it allows you to hear everyone else praying alongside you more clearly. And it's just a liberating feeling.
And they removed that just after the end of Passover. So the phrase was, let my people be unmasked, the take on Passover this year. And Rabbi, you're no stranger to the Eagles Wings family, the global Eagles Wings community. We do always have newcomers every time on the program. But tell us, just remind us, how many children do you have and how are your children acclimating to life in Israel? It's very different than life in Manhattan.
It certainly is. And I would just comment, I'm not new to the Eagles Wings family, and it's been one of the blessings of my life, you know, to be included as part of that family. As you noted, we met over a decade ago, and, you know, you were just mentioning, a few moments ago that it's a relationship that's been, waiting for 2000 years to happen. Right. And, it's interesting because today in Israel, it might not be felt so much in the United States, but today in Israel is actually Israel Independence Day, Yom HaTzma'ut. Right. And we're celebrating our 74th birthday, as it were, as a country, as a modern state.
Right.
And that was also something that we've been waiting 2,000 years for. And it's something that I think is appropriate to bring up in the context of the 2,000-year-in-waiting relationship between Jew and Christian, because the Christian community in particular, your community and the broader evangelical community, have been the greatest allies that the Jewish state and the Jewish people have known in all of its years, since the destruction of our temple and our exile from Israel. We have not had friends like the evangelical Christian community has proven to be for us. And so your remarks about the 2000 year in waiting relationship with the Christian community is, I think, beautiful to highlight and to celebrate in the context of the state of Israel, this still unfolding miracle in our lifetime. And that also we waited 2000 years to see.
Well, and for those of us who are believers, your beautiful words that you've just expressed so eloquently, these become signs for us, right? It's signs of the providence of Hashem. It's signs that the hand of God is actively at work in human history, and that there is an architect of the universe, and he has plans. And sometimes those plans don't happen on our timing. We wish they would happen a little bit more rapidly. But when we look back at the arc of history, we see that God does perform his word. He keeps his promises. And it's remarkable to see. You talked for a moment about Yom HaTzma'ut. Let's go there for a second. Because, of course, today, we think of May 14th as the celebration of Israel's independence. But help us understand, because, again, we get into the complexity of the lunar calendar versus the solar calendar. Help us understand why it's today, Yom HaTzma'ut, and not the 14th.
Sure. It's a little bit complicated, but it probably makes sense to take a couple steps back in history to the very first Yom HaTzma'ut, when Ben-Gurion declared the independent Jewish state and immediately prepared for the onslaught of Arab armies who would try to drive us into the sea in 1948. And that took place, as you point out, on May 14th. The truth is, Ben-Gurion's declaration was supposed to take place the next day on May 15th. Because the British were leaving Palestine, as it was called then, and essentially leaving the Jews to their fate and to defend their new country on the 15th of May. But that was a Saturday.
The British mandate was coming to an end.
Correct.
And they were preparing to leave, but the British were no friend of the Jews. They had kept the Jews, even those escaping the Holocaust, they'd kept them out as best they could. And so Ben-Gurion is faced with this issue that the day that the British are leaving is a Shabbat, right? And so, right. You know, you've got the sanctity of the Shabbat. I mean, you know, you think of this, he's got to balance the sanctity of the Shabbat with invading Arab armies. Like this is the reality of right. what this man has to deal with. And if you've come to Israel with me, you know that to me, one of the most sacred places that we go all the time, and most tours do not go there, but we go to Independence Hall in Tel Aviv, and we go to the home of Meir Dizengoff, which was the site where Ben-Gurion declared the state. And it's one of our favorite places to go. And so bring us back into the story, Rabbi. The British are about to leave on
They're
Shabbat.
About to leave. And, yep. and the, you know, the declaration that is going to be made by Ben-Gurion is of epic historic significance. The Jewish people are now going to have a state of their own in the land of Israel after 2,000 years of praying and waiting and yearning and suffering along the way. That historic moment is timed and really altered in terms of its timing in order to honor the sanctity of the Sabbath. It is a beautiful moment. You know, it's exquisite Incredible. When you think about it. Ben-Gurion himself Incredible. Was not a religiously observant Jew, but he Right. understands. He understood that the historic significance for the Jewish people and really for the world of the Jewish return to Israel and the establishment of a sovereign Jewish state, it was so important. It could not be done in a way that in any way undermined the sanctity of the Shabbat, of the Sabbath. And so he brought it earlier and
Because the very definition, the very identity of the Jewish people is so inextricably linked to Shabbat. You know, the famous saying, the Jews kept Shabbat and Shabbat kept the Jews. You know, exactly you cannot that. Separate the Jews and Shabbat. You know, other holidays, they're important, they're powerful, of course, but this every week honoring the Sabbath, which again, we bring to the Christian community, and I keep reminding us all, you know, honoring the Sabbath made God's top 10 list. It's right up there with do not commit murder and do not steal. I mean, it's in God's top 10 list. And yet we as Christians, you know, we decided to change the day, and someone still has to give me a good answer. I challenge anybody out there on the internet to give me a good answer how we had authority. Who gave the Christian church authority to change the day of the Sabbath? And by the way, that was not the practice of the early church. The early followers of Yeshua would never have thought of desecrating the Sabbath or changing the Sabbath. They always kept Shabbat. And then they also had a day of celebration on Sunday in honor of the resurrection. But it was not to the replacement of Shabbat. And it was not until the Council of Nicaea, and I believe it was 324, that Constantine really messed things up and laid the axe to the root, not only of Shabbat, but of Passover and of so many of these things. And really that loss was extraordinary. So, Rabbi, it's just incredible that Ben-Gurion, even though he was not a Orthodox Jew, There is within the soul of every Jew this understanding of the sanctity of time, and most specifically, the sanctity of Shabbat.
Exactly that. And that has translated into the scheduling of the celebrations of Yom HaAtzmaut, of Israel Independence Day, for all times. The fifth of the Jewish month of Iyar, was the date that Ben-Gurion made his declaration. And therefore, it was decided that the fifth of the Jewish month of Iyar will always be the day of Yom HaAtzma'ut, except consistent with his own sensitivity to the sanctity of Shabbat, we follow Ben-Gurion's lead. And whenever the day of 5 Iyar would fall on a Friday, we bring Yom HaAtzma'ut on the calendar one day earlier so that it doesn't rub up against the Sabbath. And certainly if it would fall on the Sabbath itself. But we always make sure that the celebrations of our independence don't come at the expense of the sanctity of the Shabbat. And it's a really beautiful and very powerful message that I think is embedded within even the modern Jewish calendar.
And it speaks to the Jewish commitment to sanctify time. And this is, for me, I think, just the most fascinating, powerful aspect of Jewish tradition. It's the ability to bring the eternal into the temporal, to bring that which is transcendent into that which is mundane. We would say to bring heaven to earth and to understand that link between the two. It's confusing because we're very scripted in, you know, kind of the Gregorian calendar and in things being very, very fixed. But when you pay attention to time, it really does, it makes such a difference. Now, Rabbi, another confusing thing, and we're going deep down some bunny trails tonight, but I love it because I love this stuff. And so, everybody else is getting blessed, but I'm getting blessed. Very unusually, because this does not normally happen. I mean, it happens cyclically, but it's not normal. There is a difference tonight in the Parsha that is read in Israel versus the Parsha that's read in the diaspora. Now, if the word diaspora is new to you folks, diaspora is any of the Jews that live outside the land of Israel. So Jews living in Miami or in Brooklyn or in Hong Kong or wherever they are in the diaspora. And there are some different timings that are given for Jews living in the diaspora versus Jews living in the land of Israel. And one of those differences in timing leads to this week a different parsha being read in Israel versus in the diaspora. So, Rabbi, without confusing us too much, bring us into that.
Well, I'll bring you into it, but with a tiny bit of background. You mentioned so beautifully the concept of sanctifying time. Now, in Judaism, from a Torah perspective, the notion of sanctifying time was one where the servant of God was asked to partner with God in establishing and in bringing sanctity into time. And one of the ways that the Torah does that is by essentially, in a ideal system, allowing each month to be established. When is the first day of the month? It's not based on a set calendar as we have nowadays, but in biblical times and when the temple stood and when there was a high religious court in Jerusalem, each month was declared based on the testimony of witnesses who arrived in Jerusalem and they said, last night we saw the sliver of the new month, the new moon. And therefore the court would say, it means that it's time to declare the sanctity of Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of a new month, and then you'd start counting from that day for all of the relevant holidays in that month. And it was a way of engaging the people. It was based on a human being looking heavenward and taking in a sight, taking in the marvels of God's creation, the sliver of the new month, which symbolized renewal. And he would go with that information and that image in his head of the new moon to Jerusalem. And based on his testimony, the new month would be declared. Now, and if it wasn't, if it was cloudy, obviously we didn't postpone it indefinitely. It would be the next day. But
yeah.
But yep. So what would happen is everybody would start their count for the holidays in that month based on the declaration. But what happened if you lived far away from Jerusalem? What happened if you lived outside of Israel entirely and you didn't have, you know, email, texting, a phone to pick up, to call and tell them, ah, you know, today was declared as the beginning of the new Hebrew month. Start counting to your holidays. What if you didn't know? Well, Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, is always going to be one of 2 days because the lunar month, which the Jewish calendar is based on, is 29 and a half days, give or take a few minutes. And you know, so it's going to be one of 2 days. So if it wasn't one day, it was going to be the other day. So in the diaspora outside of Israel, where they didn't get clear information as to when the new month began, they would treat both potential days as the beginning of the month, and they would count for their holidays from both of those days. Essentially, what it meant is that they were adding a day to all of the Jewish holidays.
Rabbi, this is why, for example, Passover, biblically, Passover is 7 days and it's celebrated 7 days in Israel, but in the diaspora outside, it's an 8-day holiday. So there's an extra day added outside of Israel to holidays, just in case you weren't in perfect alignment with that calendar. And when you talk about those witnesses seeing that sliver of the moon and bringing that report to Jerusalem, first of all, I think it's incredible that it was declared when they brought the report to Jerusalem, because it's almost like time itself is issuing forth from Jerusalem, right? It says the word of the Lord will go, the law will go forth out of Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So time itself is being marked by witnesses in Jerusalem. That is so powerful. And the second thing I love about that is that beautiful verse, I believe it's Psalms, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The earth shows forth his handiwork. So the heavens themselves are telling a story. You know, the stars and the sun and the moon, they're not just up there as some kind of, you know, gaseous, orb that's burning, you know, fuel. They are part of God's story. They are declaring something. Creation is speaking the story of God. And as you said, as they lifted their eyes and they saw the stars or they saw the sliver of the moon, they were coming into alignment with the story that God is telling. It's incredible.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And you know, the moon, when you think about drawing inspiration, you know, from God's creation, the Jews would always look towards the moon throughout their experience, especially in exile, when they were suffering, when it seemed like their days were numbered as a people. They would look to the moon, and the fact that the skies would go black from the moon, but then the sliver would reappear and begin to grow, was always seen as a symbol of God smiling on his people, saying, don't worry. Even when it seems like times are black and things are impossibly difficult, the sliver of light will return. I think that's a really, you know, it's a beautiful metaphor. And as you say, it was, you know, the heavens themselves, as it were, you know, bringing sanctity to time. And what happened was essentially, you know, that the sages decreed that even after we had a set calendar and we were expelled from Jerusalem by the Romans, even when we had a fixed calendar and there was no longer any doubt in the diaspora as to when, still the sages said that we want the Jews in diaspora to keep the holidays as their forefathers in the diaspora kept it. So even mm-hmm. today in America, you'll have 8 days of Passover, as you pointed out, whereas in Israel, we'll only have seven. But on certain years, that creates a peculiar situation, which you highlighted, where we'll be reading different Torah portions. And the reason for that is simply this. The last day of Passover in the United States and throughout the diaspora this year. So in Israel, the last day of Passover was Friday. And what in the diaspora they were observing as an eighth day of Passover, for us was already just a regular Sabbath. And therefore, we returned to the regular Torah portion cycle. And so we are placed 1 week ahead of you at this point. You know, and at some point in late July, actually, you know, the communities around the world outside of Israel will read a double portion and catch up with us. But until then, we are one portion off from the rest of the world here in Israel.
Well, that just shows that Israel's always ahead of the curve. I think that's what it is. Israel's always a step ahead. And Rabbi, I want to, for a moment, just change topics briefly and talk about the fascinating work that you're doing with Yakir.org. You know, you're the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. You're the president of the New York City Board of Rabbis. Your whole world is wrapped up in Jewish life. You make aliyah to Israel. And one would think that you would, you know, you're going to get involved with a yeshiva, or you're going to get involved with some kind of educational outreach or something within the Jewish people. But what you choose to do so amazingly is represent the pluralism and the outreach of the Jewish people and of the state of Israel by honoring the image of God in others and reaching out to non-Jews who are residents and citizens of Israel. Most particularly the Bedouin community and the Druze community. Now, these are two communities that people don't talk about a lot. They don't, you know, most people don't know about them until they go to Israel and they kind of encounter them. The Druze are a kind of sect or an offshoot of Islam. So if you kind of want to just think of some, you know, maybe you want to think of, I don't know, Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons or something that's an offset, a sect that is different from but has its roots within. So the Druze are an offshoot, a sect, not really a sect of Islam. They're an offshoot of Islam. And the Bedouins, of course, are a people who choose to live in the desert almost identically to the way they lived thousands of years ago. They're desert dwellers. Tell us about why did you choose to take your energy, your time, and devote it toward building bridges of understanding and making the lives of Druze and Bedouins better in the land of Israel. Tell us about that journey.
It's a good question, and the premise of the question that I planned and chose this path is one that actually doesn't apply. As with so many things in life, you know, God leads you down a certain path that was totally unexpected. I had never met in my life a member of the Druze community, and there are about 140,000 of them in Israel, but they live in villages that are very separate from the population centers, the cities, you know, Jewish areas. And so a typical tourist will not encounter them on a personal one-on-one level, nor had I had much exposure to the Bedouin community. But on a trip to Israel, planning for my aliyah, planning for when I would move to Israel, there was a devastating terror attack that that struck a synagogue in Jerusalem in the Har Nof community. Jews were at morning prayer in the middle of the week, and two terrorists with hatchets and butcher knives, you know, brutes, really beasts, went into this place of prayer and started slaughtering and butchering people at prayer. And over the radio, the word went out that there is a terror attack in progress. And the closest police officer to this horrific attack was a fellow named Zidane Seif of blessed memory, who was a traffic cop. He didn't have any of the weapons that are necessary to fight terrorists. He didn't have any bulletproof vest or any of the other protective gear that an anti-terror fighter would normally arrive with. but he was close by. He heard over the radio, and like a hero, he rushed to the scene and engaged these terrorists at point blank range, a gunfight. He killed one of them, but drew both of them away from further victims, and ended up taking a bullet to the head from the second terrorist, and he died. He was a young man. He left behind a 20-year-old widow and their only first and only child, young daughter named Lorraine. It was a horrible situation that begot another, tragic, passing of this police officer. They were obviously the terror victims, and then there was this hero who fell in the line of duty. And I was there, and so I went to visit one of the families of a victim that I knew. While I was there, it occurred to me that there's another family that is grieving right now, grieving terribly over the loss of their loved one. And that's the family of this police officer. And I discovered that this police officer was not Jewish. He was Druze. The Druze community, they serve in the IDF. They oftentimes, after their mandatory service, continue to serve in the armed forces or in the police force of Israel. And this police officer was Druze. And so I drove up north to the village where his family lived to pay them a condolence call. And it was a transformative experience for me. I met an incredible family.
Was he from Itzafia?
He wasn't from Itzafia. He was from a town called Yanukhjat. Not so far from Itzafia. There are 11, 12 different villages where the Druze live.
Right.
And in that village, it was remarkable to meet people who love their country, who are willing to sacrifice for their country. And through this family, this grieving family, I got to know the broader Druze community, the leading religious leaders, the religion lay leaders, and I got to know a people that is truly inspiring. And I'll actually, as an aside, if on the next mission that you lead to Israel, you'd like to, to meet people within the community, deep in where tourists wouldn't normally find themselves, it would be my pleasure to join you. But these Druze are a wonderful, deeply spiritual people. You mentioned that they're offshoot maybe historically from Islam, and that's likely the case. But in terms of their belief system, they
very
don't
different.
Believe
very different.
Very different. Their prophet and leader is not Muhammad. They believe that their founding prophet and leader is Jethro.
That's right. Moses' father-in-law.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they believe that in addition to having a strong commitment to loyal citizenship and serving their country, when it comes to Israel, there's a special element in the sense that they believe that just as Jethro stood side by side with Moses, that so too they should stand side by side with the Jewish people and always be there, both in good times and in bad, to sacrifice and to be there to help build the Jewish state. So a remarkable people. And after that introduction to this community, it seemed to me that if there was a way that I could deepen relationships between Jews and Druze and other minority communities that are loyal to the Jewish state, that this was something that was natural. When you think about Israel and how for so many years things are starting to change, thank God, there are more peace treaties. But for so many years, for most of our existence as a modern country, we've had so few friends. And when I mentioned before that the evangelical community has established itself as this unique group that stands by Israel, in terms of peoples, that might be in that category of those willing to stand by and sacrifice for Zion, the Druze are people that are not only willing, to tolerate the Jewish people. We haven't had enough of different peoples that have been willing to tolerate us through the years, but these are people who are willing to die alongside us in the army.
Incredible.
It's a remarkable thing. So running programs that deepen the relationship, and deepen the understanding, that to me seems like a beautiful way of strengthening the Jewish state that's now my home.
And it's so beautiful, Rabbi. And how did that then extend towards the Bedouin community, which the Bedouin community is, I think, you know, from my perspective, and I'm not certainly the expert that you are, but the Bedouin community is a little more challenging because I know at times there's a lot of Palestinian, you know, kind of anti-Israel influence that can try to co-opt the Bedouin community, and the Bedouin community is so isolated, it's kind of up for grabs. I don't think, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but please inform me, I don't think the Bedouin community volunteers for military service as often or as regularly. Maybe they do in isolated incidents, and I could be incorrect, but bring us into the conversation a little bit about the Bedouin community.
Right. So the Bedouin community, you are correct, is very different from the Druze community. The Druze community already more than a half a century ago accepted upon themselves as a community to be conscripted into the IDF, into the army in Israel on a mandatory basis. So all of their sons are, you know, automatically enlisted in the IDF. The Bedouin community never made such an arrangement, and it is true that the Bedouin community is very complex. I started working initially with the Bedouins in northern Israel, who are Bedouins in name, but don't fit the, you know, the cultural image of the Bedouin that you describe in terms of living in tents and wandering in the desert. They live in homes and they live in communities. And on a day like today, Israel Independence Day, you'll see Israeli flags flying from their homes in communities like Zarzir up north, where many Bedouins live. The northern Bedouins, in general, serve in the IDF. At least within every family, there's generally at least one son that serves. Oftentimes, there'll be large families, and they'll decide amongst themselves which will serve and which will begin working to support the family. But as families, they feel a loyalty and the responsibility to serve and sacrifice. And they've paid a hefty price in terms of fallen soldiers as well in Israel's wars and in defense of the country. Down south, the Bedouin community is very complicated. And there are those who are very loyal and whose sons serve in the IDF and who support the state. And then, as you mentioned, there are many that have intermarried with Gazans, where obviously the anti-Israel right. sentiment is fairly radical. And there has been a radicalization of those communities, which has led to many clashes between Israelis and those Bedouins who not only don't serve in the IDF, but actually, you know, act, you know, to undermine the security and the safety of Israel. No, I don't work with Bedouin, them, to be honest.
do Bedouins practice traditional Islam, or is there some unique, or is it traditional Islam?
It's fairly traditional Islam. It's fairly traditional Islam, in terms of their in terms of their belief system, which makes, you know, integration and intermarriage with the people of Gaza, who are obviously not Bedouins, quite natural and easy. Obviously, they have a different lifestyle and culture, but in terms of their belief system, it integrates well into classical Islam. The work that I do, to be honest, is with what I would call the low-hanging fruit. I'm for developing and deepening relationships between Jews and all of the minority communities in Israel who want Israel to succeed. Some of them demonstrated by serving in the army. Some of them don't, but they still work with Israel, cooperate with Israel, you know, have fruitful relationships with Israelis. And I want those relationships to be as deep as possible, including the Christian community. And we have we've done projects as well with the South Lebanese Christian community that moved to Israel from Lebanon. And they all serve in the army as well. Many of them right. continue to serve in the police forces as well. It's very important because all of these groups live and worship amongst themselves. There's very little social interaction and therefore very little understanding between the different groups. And for me, it's very important to facilitate and to nurture these relationships so that these individuals are not just, you know, curiosities that are far away, but are real, you know, deep, warm, real people.
Rabbi, tell us about either a recent project you did or an upcoming project you're going to do that you're excited about that demonstrates, you know, the kind of work that you're doing. I think it's just amazing. And I hope our listeners will understand this. You know, folks, it is so important. 40 times in the Hebrew Bible, it says that we're to welcome the stranger. How do we welcome the stranger? How do we welcome the foreigner? And a lot of times, we can, out of a sense of protecting our own identity and protecting our own, belief systems, we can keep others away. But that's the opposite of what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches you should be so strong in your belief system. You should be so clear in your identity and in who you are and in what you believe and in how you live your faith that you're able to easily welcome and interact with people from different backgrounds so that you can share the light that's within you, so that you can share the hope that's within you. And so 40 times scripture says, welcome the stranger, welcome the one that is different from you, welcome them, and how you treat them is considered so important in scripture. And Rabbi, you're a living example of this to us. Tell us either a recent or an upcoming program that demonstrates the kind of thing that you're doing.
I'll tell you one of the most beautiful annual programs that we have. So it's both past and upcoming. And it's on the week that we read the portion of Yitro in the Torah. Every year, we bring hundreds of Druze from the north to Jerusalem and usually also to Tel Aviv for Shabbat, for the Sabbath, and we celebrate together. We have in synagogues, we host services where we recite memorial prayers for the fallen soldiers of the Druze community and those who have died in terror attacks. We integrate, which is something which is very special because it doesn't happen enough that we integrate people from outside our religious faith communities into the service as well, such that, and we typically have services among the various programs. We have a major gathering and service on Shabbat morning, on the Sabbath morning, at the Great Synagogue of Jerusalem. And the lay leadership of the synagogue was so moved by the concept of this community, of this community program, that they allowed me to assign various Druze religious leaders to, for instance, open the ark during the synagogue service, to stand up on the podium during the recitation of prayers.
A high honor.
We, in Hebrew, we would recite prayers, memorial prayers, the same memorials that we would recite for people who had passed away or who had fallen in the service of the country's defense. Within the Jewish community, we recited those prayers on behalf of Druze fallen soldiers. We actually had a beautiful situation where I mentioned before the family which initially inspired my engagement with this community, the Safe family. So on every one of these programs, their entire expanded family comes. And on the past program in the Great Synagogue, the widow, who has since actually gotten married again, thank God, actually, interestingly, to the younger brother of her murdered first husband. Quite interesting. Wonderful couple. And they've since had a daughter of their own since then. But on this particular Yitro celebration with the Druze at the Great Synagogue, she was up in the ladies' gallery, as it were. They have a balcony for the women in that particular synagogue. And she was with her young daughter, who's now already 5-6 years old. And the cantor in the synagogue is chanting the memorial prayer for Rinal, the widow's late husband, who died a heroic death fighting these terrorists in Jerusalem. And in the process, he calls out the name Zidan Seif. And the little girl who, you know, until that point, was just distracted with all of the goings on in this unfamiliar, you know, religious place of worship and looking around and not obviously paying attention to the all Hebrew service going on, hears her late father's name mentioned. She doesn't even remember her late father. All she knows of her late father is through the heroic stories that are told about him, because she was only a couple months old when her father died. And all of a sudden, in this crowded synagogue with 1,000, 1,500 people gathered, everyone standing during this prayer that's being recited, which, you know, she didn't even register as something of, you know, of significance to her in her little girl's life. All of a sudden, she hears her father's name, and she calls out to her mother next to her. And you could hear, because there's no talking going on during the recitation of the prayer, and somebody calls out, "That's my father." And all of a sudden you realized, you know, that, you know, what we've done is we've communicated to a girl whose father was robbed from her, by brutal terrorists.
Incredible.
That she sees and everyone else sees, Jew Incredible. And Druze alike, sees that we're standing as a community representing a people in the largest synagogue in the world, and honoring him as a hero of Israel. And that's really what it's all about. It's letting them know that we relate to them as people, as brothers, and it's fulfilling. It really is. And I think that, you know, we and you both often cite the prophecy of Israel being a light unto the nations. Now, it's not just about, you know, the example, you know, of freedom-loving people, you know, in a difficult part of the world that Israel is, and all of our scientific innovation. And, you know, it's also about recognizing the infinite value of other human beings, all of us who are created in the image of God. And that's part of what we're trying to do.
Well, I have chills and tears at this incredible story, and you're doing holy work. Folks, I want you to check out yakir.org, yakir.org, to keep up with Rabbi's amazing journey. The rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue in Manhattan, who left the comfort of Manhattan to make Aliyah, and now is making such a difference. Folks, it's been an amazing, amazing night. We've been literally to the moon and back, and we have figured out finally why the diaspora holidays are a day longer. We've understood that time itself is declared from Jerusalem. When the witnesses show up in Jerusalem, that's how you know when the new month begins. And we're understanding why at times the Parsha in Israel doesn't line up exactly with the Parsha in the diaspora, but it does then reconnect and come back together a little later in the year. And Rabbi, it has just been absolutely fascinating as always. We're so grateful. You're all the way over there in Israel, and yet you take your time to teach us, and it's so, so meaningful to us. And Rabbi, we're going to sign off, but just give us a closing thought, a closing word before we sign off and say goodbye to you in Jerusalem.
One more thing that we studied together today was that the entire world and unfolding history can wait in order to honor the sanctity of the Sabbath. And I think all of us have to remember, you know, in our busy lives, that we have to take a step back at times and respect the sanctity of time.
So powerful. Yeah, I will now forever incorporate that into our visit when we go to Independence Museum. I knew about him doing this before the Shabbat, but did not understand the complexity of it. And now that that is still honored with Yom HaTzma'ut that we celebrate today, moving in regard to that. So Rabbi, as always, you have taught us brilliantly and beautifully. And you should be blessed and walk in the grace and the light of the Lord. Continue to follow this amazing Jew, Jesus of Nazareth, and to learn not only to have faith in Jesus, but to understand the faith of Jesus is so vitally important in this generation, where the followers of Jesus and the relatives of Jesus are once again uniting in friendship and cooperation. So God bless you all. God bless you, Rabbi, in Jerusalem. And to all of you, remember, keep praying for the peace of Jerusalem.
Hey, thanks for joining us today. If you want to learn more about Eagle's Wings or become a partner to advance this global movement, visit www.eagleswings.org. Make sure you're following along on Facebook at Robert Stearns and Instagram at Dr. Robert Stearns to stay up to date and get the latest on everything that is happening. Until next time, blessings, and keep praying for the peace of Jerusalem.